You're listening to the Student Leadership Programme podcast.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Nicole. I'm an occupational therapist in London. And today I'd like to welcome Regan Stavart. She's the clinical lead specialist occupational therapist in the community neurology team in beautiful Kingsland, Norfolk. So, Regan, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. And I'd like to start off with maybe you could tell us a little bit more about your current role and why you chose occupational therapy.
Oh, thank you, Nicole. I'm so honored to be invited to do a talk with you guys. Hopefully, I'll be able to just give justice to the expectations. I'm an occupational therapist, as Nicole has said. I specialize in neurology, so I am a clinical lead OT in a very small team in West Norfolk. I look after patients in the community to keep them as well as possible and help them be comfortable being out of hospital and obviously liaise with other MDTs. That's part of my job. I look after patients with neurological conditions that can range from brain injury, spinal cord injury, Huntington's disease, complex Parkinson's disease, or multiple sclerosis, and all those neurological conditions. I can't name them all, but everything except a stroke, because another trust looks after the stroke patients. It is a very highly clinical job, but I also have some managerial responsibilities. I say some because I feel like most of the time I do a lot of clinical work and clinical teaching. And my the managerial part of the job is mainly to facilitate learning, supervise and mentor occupational therapists within my team, the juniors, even peers of the same level, as well as the other teams sometimes come to us for advice as well to discuss certain cases. But mainly my job is around my small number of OTs and juniors and students or anyone who's on rotation. So I work in a small team with different specialties, different professions. There are physiotherapists, speech and language therapists, specialist nurses, and psychologists, clinical psychologists. We work well together looking after this variety of neuro patients. And we discuss who best to see them at a certain point on the referral to the team and when best to see them. And obviously we help one another in obviously facilitating recovery if that is possible or maintaining them to be well in community. I hope I give that a very concise and just explanation of my role.
Yeah, it sounds like a very important role and definitely very interesting with all the different conditions you see as well, I'm sure. I wanted to ask about actually, how did you get there in your current role? And could you tell us a little bit about your journey and becoming a leader?
Yes, I think it was a very organic trajectory into becoming a leader. To be honest, I still feel a bit uncomfortable or a bit, I feel like there's a imposter syndrome whenever someone says you're a leader attached to my clinical role. I've always been interested in clinical work. I love working with patients, but the more you are an expert about your role and your job, you do rise up in the ranks in the sense that you're given more responsibilities and then you start teaching peers, colleagues, and juniors. So it was quite organic. I never meant to be, and I'm still a bit hesitant to lead. I always find it, I'm a bit self-conscious leading people. So my leadership style is more about setting example or leading by example, more or less. I got here by, I was quite lucky with the rotations I've had as a band five and gaining experience and having a taste of different specialities. Cardiac and surgical and all those experiences I've had along the years helped me hone my clinical expertise. Basically, I wouldn't say I'm an expert, but I would say it honed my neurological experience, having worked in stroke before as well. And from then on, You apply for a certain role because you find that that's a specialty you want to work in. And along the years, you just develop and be more experienced. And people then would seek your help. People then would come to you for more difficult situations, and more clinical discussions come to your lap, or other people would seek your advice. Then that leadership role becomes more natural, and it becomes more, as I said, very organic in that sense. Taking on a clinical lead role was more comfortable for me, in the sense that you need to be good at your clinical reasoning. And every time I have a bout of a bout of loss of confidence, I always go back to my clinical practice, and then that self-doubt always goes out of the window. Every time I have a discussion with any of my juniors, when they seek your advice, it sometimes reminds you why you're in that role, and it humbles you at the end of the day, because in each discussion you also learn from them. Sometimes they present to you a situation you've never had before, so you learn together. And I suppose that is my style of leadership. It's basically just presenting the best of your ability, showing, getting it out there and sharing your experiences with them, because you've had more experiences from a lot of them in certain cases. So you get to be involved in these discussions. Hence, people will look up to you as a leader more than anything else, I suppose. And I think that's why I feel comfortable in that word leadership, and if I put it to that clinical word beside it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think for me, someone a lot earlier in my career as an OT, it's really, really reassuring for someone like myself, because I feel imposter syndrome like from day
Yes.
one that I started
You
working.
never get rid of that.
So
You
I
never
think,
get rid of that, I think. Yeah.
yeah, it's really reassuring for me to know like someone's in such a like a lead and like very impressive position, what can still feel like that, and you can still make an influence. And also I love that in the student leadership program, we learn a lot about like contemporary styles of leadership and how it's not just about telling people to, it's like an authoritarian style. Like, we don't do that
Yes.
anymore. And it's nice to hear that in practice that you can feel very like imposter syndrome for yourself, but it's more about connecting with others and having your diverse background. So
I
that's really
think
interesting.
you've put it really well, actually. Coming from a Southeast Asian background, where a lot of the teachers and leaders would be authoritative in their stance, and somewhat that was accepted, that they tell you what to do or this is how to do it. But here it's more collaborative coaching style. And that's something I actually bring with me, and that's something that I actually learn more from. So I thought that if I need to facilitate learning in someone, I have to be more collaborative and more coachy than telling them what to do. And I really feel that's more empowering to anyone who wants to be with you and wants to work with you. So I always think of it that way. If I was in their shoes, I'd be the same. I'd rather be working with someone who's more of a facilitator, someone who's more collaborative worker, than this is what you should be doing, A, B, and Z.
Yeah, definitely. I think so myself, I'm my background is Chinese and my family's from Hong Kong. So I think I love being in the UK for that, because I think growing up, it's very authoritarian. It starts with your family, right? And then you go into the workplace and you're taught not to question anybody superior to you. So even when I started working as an OT, I felt that in my work relationships, like if someone asked me to do something, then I would not question it. And sometimes I feel hesitant to take initiative, but slowly I learn more about the culture here and then kind of like undo those assumptions and feel a lot more empowered to take initiative and work, as you said, collaboratively with other
I love
people.
that. But I think, you know what? From our background, we can take a part of it that's really good, being teachable. I think first, when someone tells you what to do, and if you're working with different people, different backgrounds, you start. Even though you might have a question in your head, like what we are with our parents, we don't question them, don't we? Because we're not allowed to. But here you are allowed to question, you're respectively, of course, you are allowed to question. But I think being able to question in a manner, but at the same time, okay, let me try their suggestion first and see if that works and learn from it. And if it doesn't work, being able to have that confidence to say, we've tried your way, it didn't work. Can we try it my way now? Maybe that's a different approach we need to be able to bring. Because saying that, I think some people as well of I wouldn't say everyone, but some people find it hard who are not from our culture find it hard to be taught. It's like they've been there in their roles for a long time. They find it difficult. There's a new system change, a new thing that comes over. It's difficult to change them because they don't want to be taught, I've been here on this role forever. But I think the beauty about coming from our culture is that we're teachable. We are open to being presented that something that we're not used to, and then try it out, and then try it out for ourselves. I think there's a beauty in both worlds that we have the benefit of practicing now, isn't it?
Definitely, like taking the best parts of both cultures,
Exactly.
really.
That's what we should be doing.
Yeah, and just to introduce, so could you tell us a little bit about your cultural background, just so we can introduce to the audience? I know you
Oh, that's
explained to me a
true.
little.
Yeah, that's true. To anyone listening right now, I'm from the Philippines. I've lived there until I was 26. I moved here to the UK at 26, 27, and then I worked in the NHS since then. So all my working life, it's always been the NHS since coming to the UK. So I did occupational therapy in the Philippines to study OT, but never practiced OT. At that time, there wasn't a lot of avenues to do OT back home, but there were other things that got my interest to be working at. But then I came to the UK and practiced OT, and then it presented a different world to me. So coming from that background and coming to the UK was quite, I would say, enriching for me. At the same time, it gave me a broader sense of the world. It was the challenges that came with it was obviously working with people of a different background to yours and different mindset, different culture, different language. So that was a difficulty. And at first coming here, you were trying to assimilate too much. You tried to water down your being Asian so that you feel like you're more accepted. But as you grow into your role, as you work within that role, you actually notice that, my being different is actually a plus. There's a lot of things that I carry to the job, that experience from a different background that I carry to the job, and it's actually a pickle in my burger. I always refer to the pickle in the burger. It's like you're the extra taste that you add, because everyone's a burger in the hospital, and you've got a different pickle. You've got a chutney. So that's I always say that it's the flavor that I bring to the job. Yes, and I feel that resilience coming from that background I bring to the job as well, especially in these trying times. Now that we've got the COVID situation, so don't know when we're gonna get out of this. But you just bring that. Okay, keep going at it. I think that's a plus to me.
Yeah, definitely.
Have I answered your question?
Yeah, no, that was really interesting. I mean, to share a little bit about my background, I came to the UK similar age, around 26, 27. So I was born in Canada, but grew up in Hong Kong, and then I went back to Canada, and then I came here to study OT. But I studied actually in Leeds in Northern England, and that was quite a cultural shock to me as well, because I've always, in Vancouver, it's quite diverse. In Hong Kong, obviously Chinese people are the majority. So it was quite a shock to me to, and as you said, I really, in the beginning, you want to try and fit in, like try to learn the local culture, so you don't, almost like you're afraid to like offend people or make a bad impression of your own culture, which is actually a really sad thing to say.
Yes, isn't
But
it?
after a while, like I like how you put it, the metaphor of the pickle and the burger, you realize actually, especially in healthcare, you actually have a lot to offer because, with all this conversations and social movements about, systemic racism, about health inequalities, actually the ethnic minority, they're the people that need extra support, especially during times like COVID. But how, it's such a big, it's such a vague topic as well. Like, how can we actually be more inclusive and understanding of these populations? And even as a staff member, like, what are the barriers that we go through? So I wanted to ask you about that as well. So working as an occupational therapist and working in healthcare, what are some challenges and barriers have you come across?
I think if I put it in context, I need to backtrack a little bit. So I did say that I worked, I studied IRT in the Philippines, but didn't practice it. Moved here at 26. Then my first job here was NHS, but that was a therapy assistant in one of the hospitals in the inner London. And then I met so many interesting IRTs at that time, and they really inspired me. There was someone who could, who really inspired me. There was the clinical lead IRT at the time, and the manager were really good, and they actually supported me and encouraged me to retrain as an IRT back in the UK. And so I did training in the University of Essex, so I qualified there. And the different styles of learning is totally different back home. But all those experiences helped me now, because when I talk to colleagues and we discuss about certain ways, I can actually say I qualified here as well, and I kind of know that cultural aspect. But it shouldn't stop anyone who didn't qualify here to work here. They can assimilate, and they can learn, they can give what's good about them into a team, even though they didn't qualify here. I always feel that that was just a plus for me, especially with my confidence level at the time. The challenges I've experienced when I was new to the team, especially as an IRT, and you start leading Caucasians as your assistants, isn't it? Sometimes that's a difficulty, and they already have, were set in your ways, and you're introducing different different scenarios to them, was how do I get them to respect me? But I was always so conscious about how do these people believe me? How will they respect me being someone who's a qualified? But actually that comes when you are, you know your job, and at the same time understanding their professional experience being assistants, and seeking help from them as well. So respecting professional boundaries. I think where I used to come from, roles are quite important, and we respect more someone who's a doctor or who's got a higher qualification than you. But here, the beauty of being in the UK, it doesn't matter whether you're a doctor or you know what your role is, whether you're the qualified person in that role, but it's what you give to the job, and people respect you no matter what your role is, as long as you give the best of your ability, and you've got this thirst for knowledge. And I think I caught that early on, and I'm thankful that I have that thirst for knowledge, because I was so interested in learning the cultural nuances. I was interested in and it helps that I love watching UK television programs and understanding the cultural things that you don't see in you know, that patient contact, and it comes with that, doesn't it? So I thought that really helped me as well. Number one of the challenges is that cultural nuances, people like the idiomatic expressions they say. There was the first day I worked in a hospital, they said to me, they asked me about the application, about my job. And I said, so I mentioned that this is how I applied and this is when I got the interview. And then she said, and then this lady who was the therapy assistant at the time said, it was quite long-winded, wasn't it? And I just said, for some reason, I didn't understand what she meant. And I just said, yeah, it was quite windy today, but didn't realize she meant that it was the application. No wonder she mentioned that right after I mentioned the application. I said, oh, she said, no, I meant it was quite a long-winded process. So these things you just learn along the way. And, you know, those simple stuff like that, that was really important. And then where I used to work, there was a lot of Cockney slangs that they use, so I got to learn how to assimilate with that, and read up on Cockney rhymes, because a lot of people would use that. They get your respect by you trying to learn their aspect too. Yeah. They would want to know more of you because you want to know more of them. But if you actually show you're not interested, I'm just here to get paid as an OT, then that will that will bounce back like a frisbee. You need to show them that I'm so interested in that. I want to listen to that story and I want to learn from that. And then in turn, they actually learn from you. They're interested in you as well. So communication, so the language used or the slangs that was used in the job. And another thing, there's that microaggressions, I suppose, that happens. It's not blatant racist remarks, but it's that slight undertone that comes along with it. They wouldn't admit it. They wouldn't say that I've done that to do that, but or it was a joke. But you get that they don't realize, or they don't realize that you know that it was a racial slur. I do choose my battles. So I think what is important, what can I change now? And how much time do I have to battle with this? Or is this important to my day-to-day job? As long as they don't do physical harm to me or not blatant disrespect to me. But I also am someone who have a lot of energy to correct people. There was an instance that, one of the many, many instances probably, that someone said, especially during the Brexit times, Brexit discussions, they were talking about different culture. It wasn't talking about Asians at the time. And they were talking about Eastern Europeans and how they've stolen their jobs and all that. But I just said, it's not relevant to our assessment today. Can we talk about, you know, I'm here to do this job. Can we not talk about it? Because in my mind, I don't want to go into a political debate, especially you're in a limited time with an assessment. Mm-hmm. No, not you, dear. Except you, dear. They say that in a very condescending or patronizing tone. It is difficult because we work with an aging white population in this country. So some bits of the population probably haven't traveled or met different cultures. Mm-hmm. And where I work as well, especially here in Norfolk, we're not as culturally diverse as the inner cities in London or London as such. Mm-hmm. I used to work in Basildon University Hospital, where it's more culturally diverse. I work with South Africans, Chinese, different cultures, Indians. So it's more culturally diverse, colleague-wise and patient-wise. Mm-hmm. Here, majority of them are Caucasian. And to be honest, I think I'm the only brown-skinned person in the whole therapy team. Mm-hmm. Where I am in the trust. Mm-hmm. In West Norfolk. So it's those are the challenges. And I think they're a lot more careful in what they would regard as a joke nowadays, because obviously what's going on in the news about BAME, mm-hmm. That BAME is in the forefront now, and especially now this Stop Asian Hate. Yeah. And I know 99% of what people say, it's just being an ignorant comment. It's nothing to demean you as someone they respect as a colleague, but it's probably something that they just repeated that they've seen on a meme somewhere. Mm-hmm. They don't realize that is actually a racial undertone, a racist undertone when they say these things. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I choose my battles and I do correct. I do correct in some ways, being mindful that there's no point in having a big discussion. Mm-hmm. if you know you can't really change them.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing with us your experiences. That definitely completely resonates with me and my experiences, especially going, having worked as a student in Leeds and then coming here, and just a very different demographic we work with. But at the same time, as you said, like, it's about picking your battles. And sometimes, I guess it differs from person to person. If someone's upset about it, and that's fine as well. It's just how your own personal response is to it. I guess it's also about with the people, especially an aging white populations, all these unconscious biases, even with the staff you work with. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, I wonder, like, you as a clinical lead and a position of power, how do you influence the staff you work with to be more inclusive and supportive of other staff, other patients, or even new students of BAME background that come join your team?
I think it does help I always think about education and promotion of our culture as one way. There would always be resistance. Anything new is always, it's always a query, and there's always some sort of a resistance, whether whether they admit it or not. But I always feel that if you notice, really, people who have certain biases are people who are less traveled or have less contact with different cultures, but people who are more educated, I wouldn't say all of them, because I've seen a lot of racist people who are private school educated, but the more educated a person is, or the more contact they have with other cultures and understand where they come from, they are more accepting and more tolerant of the differences. I also put it in my mind that as a Southeast Asian, I always make sure that I set myself as an example of my race, of my culture. So I have to be professional at all times, and I have to give the best of my ability in everything. And I think that's a baggage I have on my shoulder every single day, because for me, I have less margin of error to give. Because if I do something right, yeah, because you're a fabulous OT, but if you do something wrong, it's like everything about me is included in the process. Oh, Filipinos are like that, or she's Asian, or that becomes a whole magnified thing now, and she's a rubbish OT because she's so and so, and I don't want it to be like that. So I have that baggage that I carry around with me, but that be you know being good is not enough. You have to be excellent at all times, and all that Asian parents tell you from the very beginning, just being good doesn't cut it. You have to be the best or the top at everything you do. And I know it's such a heavy baggage that I carry, but I suppose that's why I got to where I am, because clinically I wanted to be best at what I do, and I read and I research, and things like that will always have put me in good stead whatever I do. And I think part of it as well is unlearn or relearning to be kind to myself, because that Asian baggage is with you everywhere. Being kind to myself that I'm allowed to have mistakes and to relax a bit, so chill sometimes. But it takes a lot of practice, and that's come later in life, I think, because from as a young person, you're trying to prove yourself the whole time. Because I was working back home, I don't have to prove that as an Asian I have to do well. I just have to do well. But here you have to prove and give your best shot, because A, you need to do well because your parents tell you to do so, because that's a value you've had since as a child. And you're Asian as well. You carry that with you.
Yeah, it's like double the pressure.
It is triple, quadruple the pressure, to be honest. And yeah, it's such a pressure that we give ourselves. But did that help to where where I come from, to where I'm now? Yes, it has helped tremendously. And I suppose what I need to learn is to chill a little bit and give myself some slack. I think we all need that.
Definitely. That really validates my feelings with that. You put it really concisely and explained it really well, because as you said, like even me growing up, you've always had an imposter syndrome and not feeling like you're good enough, and like A is average. You have to be exceptional to be
Yeah,
good.
you have to be A++,
Yeah, and I guess like especially in the UK, because there's very low representation of East Asians. Like there's not many Chinese people, there's not many Filipinos. So yeah, just it's almost like some a lot of people that meet you, it could be their first contact with someone from your background, and you want
Exactly.
to be able to like communicate with them that you're just like them, but at the same time you're not. So it's a very tricky one.
Love that. I had that written somewhere in my notes today that I said, you want them to know that you are, yes, you're all the same, but different. And that different can work symbiotically together, actually. The good bits in each culture can actually be the best to make that society work. But I think a lot of people are still resistant to that.
Definitely. I guess that touches on the topic of, intersectionality and on how we have so many differences, not just race, but, being a woman, being disabled, and there's so many different things. And I guess that helps open up the conversation. And for us, like working in healthcare, helps us, open perspective for the team and the people who work with, which is great as well. And they're very lucky to have you, it sounds like.
Oh, I will. Well, I feel like I'm 1% of that whole discussion because, you know, I still, even myself, I still need to educate myself about the other sectors of the minorities out there, you know, like the LGBTQs and all the other the underprivileged, basically, like the disabled stuff. But it helps that we're in health, so we get an education about it. We see people with a lot of disabilities, and you know, that comes in training and that comes with practice along the years. But also, you as a person, your experiences of being the minority and how you manage through that resilience to get through the prejudices by other people, and that I keep mentioning microaggressions because they're not very blatant about sometimes that they're trying to be, well, it's being mean, isn't it, at the end of the day. In some ways, it's like complimenting you, but doing it the other way. You work through that and know your worth. You know, deep down, I'm good at what I do at the end of the day, and no one can tell me otherwise. And that's what you hold on. That's your core value and your core strength, and that's what keeps you going
Definitely.
at very difficult times.
Yeah, especially with the microaggressions, it's so hard to point out and you don't realize till later. And it makes you question yourself. So that's the hard thing, as you say.
Yes,
I mean, from a team perspective, like, how do you tackle, like, if it happened, for example, in your organization, how do you tackle microaggressions or even unconscious biases? Like, how do you address that problem?
I think you are allowed to correct these, and you can discuss it in a very non-confrontational way. And I think that's a difficulty. How do you confront something in an unconfrontational way? I'm sure there's some instances that I was presented before that I was questioned, or you know, sometimes you question yourself, am I not invited to this meeting because they feel I am a lesser convert, you know, I communicate less compared to other people. You sometimes question yourself, and it's just part of your personality as well, being a perfectionist, that, oh, maybe that's why they haven't invited you, but actually it's a different thing. But it can also be, you can sometimes question, is it microaggression that I wasn't invited to that meeting, you know? But there's some blatant microaggressions that they do some jokes of a certain undertone. You correct it. You can laugh with them, but correct them. Say, yeah, it is funny, but just to remind you, this is how it is right now for people like us. And then that puts everyone in different, oh yeah, they stop and think that what you actually are saying was a put down to that conversation, and just stopping them on their tracks, nipping it in the bud as much as you can. And I think also being mindful that, do I talk to them about this now when I'm so emotional about this, or do I wait a little bit when I'm more objective and talking about it? Because it does help. Being a woman with hormones and cycles, and you know, for me, that's a challenge. You become more emotional at certain times of the month, and some topics can be more sense you can be more sensitive to. But there are days that you just, you know, I talk about it objectively. So I would say I'll jot it down on my little supervision notes and discuss it with them by private. If it's a certain person that you felt they had like a little bit of a aggressive tone in their voice or discussion with you, incident with you. So you start to think, okay, I'll discuss this with them privately, but I need to calm down a bit because probably half of what I say will just be irrational or more emotions than an objective discussion. You want to be able to present what you want to present in a much more rational way, really. Because especially, to be honest, this race discussion is such an emotive discussion. It's always an emotive topic, isn't it? Whether we admit it or not. I always find that you become riled when something comes up on television and they talk about this violence about East Asians or Asians as a whole, and you do feel a bit riled up, that you say, oh, I just want to be there and just do the exact physical violence they've done to the person. But because you're so emotional, if you put that in context at work, you can't do physical aggression, obviously. When they start talking about or a discussion about, you feel that you've been not included, or you felt a bit You felt you weren't given the same amount of the same amount of privilege as everyone else because of your color or because you're from a different background, then it's good to question when you feel you've put your words together in a much more professional manner. Because at the end of the day, you don't want to be accused of being too aggressive as well. So you start to question, can I just ask if that was done because of this, or is there a more definite reason why I wasn't included? And then they can give you the right reason afterwards.
Yeah, definitely. It's such a complex problem. And I guess in the workplace, like from my experience, like I guess the most important thing that I've found really helpful is just to have a safe space to discuss these things as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I always feel anything emotive, you have to write down in bullet points what you wanted to say. So A, you're being able to present everything you wanted to ask them about, because you can be pulled into different directions, or oh no, I'm so sorry, dear, that wasn't what I was meaning to. But you mentioned these words. Can you clarify that, please? So you're able to present what you wanted to say in much more cohesive and precise manner than just being too emotional about it. I know it's
Definitely.
easily said than done.
Yeah, no, that's a really good tip. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Well, what's your top piece of advice? So for I know our audience, a lot of them are students. What's your top piece of advice for someone, especially from, ethnic minority background, when like they could be any allied health professional coming into a career, what would your top piece of advice for them would be?
I should say that just be themselves. They go into occupational therapy, AHP. They go to uni, university, wanting to learn a profession. And I would tell you, I would always, I know that deep down, people are good. There will always be a lot of people that you can be peers with. So find a buddy. Find a buddy that you can talk to, you can share with and learn from. So find a buddy of your same culture and of someone of a different culture. And I say someone of a different culture, I'd say, a Caucasian, someone who's from here, because they would give you a different perspective. You'd learn so much from them, and at the same time, they can be your advocate as well, and they will be your buddy if anyone tries to put you down or does something that's not relevant, but this can be of a racist undertone. They can be someone of your advocate and say, look, they're not like that, or they were just trying to express it in a different, or they're unable to express it in that manner, but this is what she actually meant. I think I always feel that people work better as communities. So I'm not talking about just a cultural community. I'm talking about the more, we don't work as an island. We work with different people, and I feel that the more you have in your gang and or in your boat, the better you sail. I remember my uni time in University of Essex. I'm friends with people of different background. At that time, there was because we were a mature cohort. There was people from South Africa. But majority of our cohort was British people, white people, and I had friends from all groups and my study group, and we sometimes would talk about cultures and say, oh, we didn't realize that about you, Rajan. And then I'd say, yeah, that's part of our culture. And then that open discussion actually makes you feel comfortable, and they're comfortable to talk about it because you allow them to talk about that openly, and they get to understand that, you know what, discussion about culture can be non-threatening, and it can be less emotive if it's done this way. You're educating them, they're educating you, and they will get put that in their practice in the future, because they're going to be leaders in the future as well. Those cohorts that you have who are Caucasian, born and bred in the UK, they will bring that with them, because oh, they've had a Chinese friend in uni, they've had a Filipino friend in uni who did this, and they were all awesome people, and they'll be more open to that in their future job, and that will help them as well. And for you as well, to know the cultural that you're in now, you're in the UK, it's good to assimilate. It's good to know, it's good to know what world you're living in now. We're not here to change them. We just want to work and live symbiotically with them, you know, and still be us, but at the same time, you know, try assimilation. When I say assimilation, is to be able to live a British Asian life, I would say. So I'm sure you understand what I mean. You're not here to change how the British do things. You don't. They're and I'm sure they're not, they don't want us to change. I think it's more of something that they understand where you're coming from, and I think that's a good thing. I don't know if, what the question was initially, but I think that's the inclusivity, I think, comes from that. For as a student, it starts from yourself. Know when to wear your badge of honor as a brown skinned person or a yellow skinned person on certain times. Know when it's not required. You know, because in my experience, there was some people before who just keep putting things in this situation, whether it's not even recorded in this discussion. You know, it's become a chip on their shoulder. Wear it as a badge of honor, not as a chip on your shoulder. Oh, you're like that to me because I'm Asian. That wasn't even required. No, it wasn't that. It was just because you didn't do your part in the teamwork. You know, you have to do, you know. If you've done what you're expected to do and they're still aggressive to you, then you question it. But if you haven't been able to do what was required of you, that has nothing to do with you being a certain color. It was just you being as a student that didn't provide your end of the bargain, and you're part of that group. So yeah, and you always have that mindset even at work. If I do anything, because I carry that baggage in my back of I need to work better every single day, so that I won't be told, you know, because I'm carrying the flag of my country or of some sort. So I don't want to be seen as, you know, neglecting my job, so that being a Filipino is not put in a bad light, so to speak. So from a student to being a practitioner, it has to be followed through.
I'm sure you're making all the Filipinos very proud. Well, I
Hope
love
so.
your message of how to see it really in a positive light, that I almost feel like, yeah, you're encouraging me to see it as like a power, and you have the power to change others, and the idea of creating a community and seeing yourself as a strength to educate other people,
Yeah.
and not only to empower people like with the same ethnic minority background, but also to help our white allies understand us and co-create something that's even better for everyone. So I love that. Thank you. I mean, I'd like to leave us on with a final question. What is your favorite part about your role, and what's the most rewarding part of what you're doing right now?
There's so many, but if I have to narrow it down, it's seeing how your work makes a difference in your patient's journey, in their recovery or their illness, whichever diagnosis they have. The comfort and quality of life that you give them, considering their illness as well, and for them to be able to live a life, a quality of life that they want to have with their loved ones beside them, considering all the other difficulties that come along with their diagnosis. And also, in tangible terms, I would say it's the thank you cards that sit on your desk at the end of the day, the how many thank you cards that you get, even if the journey for that patient wasn't, you know, recovery, because it depends on the diagnosis. Stroke, they always recover. Obviously, it depends on the type of stroke or how bad the stroke was, but I don't see stroke, but I'm talking about the diagnosis part. A lot of my long-term condition, they don't get better. You're just trying to maintain that quality of life as much as you can. The thank you cards that you get at the end of that is something, it's like the tangible part of the job that you feel, okay, that's a thank you, but the meaning of that is that the thank you was because to make it lighter for them, if they were the carer of that person that passed away, for example, or if they were the person that you gave that quality treatment with and made life better for them by providing a certain piece of equipment, for example. Really means a lot. And you know, the family that you help manage the patient, that's really the most rewarding thing.
Definitely. I guess I'm biased because I'm an OT too, but definitely the quality of life and promoting what really is important to the person is the is an amazing thing, really. And I'm sure all the patients in your team, it feels very, very lucky to have you and all the students listening to us. You've probably inspired many people to become future leaders. So I'd like to thank you so much again for your time today, Reagan.
Thank you, Nicole, for giving me this opportunity. But if I have to sum it all up for the students out there or practitioners out there who are OTs, to keep being hungry for knowledge. I want them to listen and observe the world out there because they learn from that. Assimilate, but don't forget the beauty in our culture, and also be teachable because we don't know everything.
Love
That's
it. Thank you.
important.
What a great message. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me do this, and I hope people can pick up something from today.
Thank you for listening to the Student Leadership Programme podcast. For more information, visit www.councilofdeans.org.uk/studentleadership.